This is Phil Ferrand, and I am going to sit down outside. I was going to go for a walk because I thought, well, that'll be fun. I'll go walk along the lane a little bit, but the wind is blowing pretty good out there. And of course, now the wind has died down. The wind was blowing pretty good out there, and there was just a lot of wind noise. So I thought I'd go sit out on my deck. I am off work today. I took a writing vacation for 3 days for Wednesday and Thursday and kind of Friday, but I'm off on Fridays anyways. But it really is a gorgeous, gorgeous day. And I'm out on my deck and it's nice and cool and there's birds chirping and every once in a while you'll probably hear a car go by. It's been a good day. I think I'm ready for the epilogue, to start the epilogue. So, and that's Oliver the cat coming up. You'll probably hear him a little bit. And I think what I'm doing for the epilogue is supposed to be, you know, kind of the big emotional moment for the book. I think I have a couple of other little emotional moments in it, so it's fine, but the epilogue's supposed to be the big one. And I knew I had this podcast to do. I actually am going in tomorrow, and so I thought, well, maybe I'll do it on the way home tomorrow, and then I thought, no, take a break, seize the day, get this done. I am a little clogged up. I think I probably mentioned last week that my father-in-law died last Thursday. So I hopped in the car, went over, spent a little bit of time with my wife until the first wave of grief had passed and they had come and gotten the body and moved the body out and went through that whole ritual. And then I ran back into work. The days all blur together after a while. I think I ran back over to see him a little bit after that. And that day, a week ago, was the day I came down sick. It's like, oh, because, you know, all the relatives are coming in and I'm having to lean back away from them and say, no, I'm sick. I'm sick. No hugging. Blah, blah, blah. I'm looking across into my backyard and there's a tree that is obviously dead out into the woods and the top is broken out of it and there's this hole in it that I can see right through the part that's broken out. So either some animal has constructed themselves a little hole right there or it just happened to break such that I could see through the bark. Lots of fascinating things. The rumbling to the side, which you probably can't tell since this is a mono mic, is one of the cats. Oliver. Okay, great. Lay down. Lay down. Lay down. If you lay down, I'll pet you. Just make sure you're laying over there. Oliver. Oliver has a drooling problem. I have never known a cat with a drooling problem. Oliver has a drooling problem. I mean, if you hold Oliver on your lap, you can be assured that if he's content, he will start slobbering all over you. Anyways, so the cold kept getting worse and worse as we were going along on Friday and Saturday. By Thursday afternoon or Friday, I knew I had it. I mean, it was, but I had already started on the Zicam, the zinc, you know, and started on the rest of the stuff, the expectorant, yada, yada, yada. Excuse me. The big question was going to be whether or not I could actually sing for the funeral. But Monday came, and I told my wife, I said, okay, let's try this thing. So around 11 o'clock at night, the funeral was at 2. 11 o'clock in the morning, the funeral was at 2. We tried it, and I opened up my mouth and sang about 3 words and started laughing because I just couldn't get any breath pressure at all behind the vocal cords. I mean, there was just nothing there. And I was hacking and coughing, and Lynette said, oh, never mind, I'll sing. And I said, no, let's just get through it once. Let me kind of blow the vocal cords out. And then I said, let's just wait. Give me 2 hours. I'll keep on the expectorant. I'll clear my throat really strong just before we walk up. I think I can make it through. I did pretty well. Didn't cough. I did go into the second chorus and start pushing a little bit, and you could just hear the crackle in my vocal cords. So then I had to back off a little bit. But, you know, we made it. We made it. People said, oh, it was lovely. You know, all that stuff. But anyways, we made it. So all is well. Everything's puttering along. Things are going along good at work. That's all good. I did come across an interesting article a couple of weeks ago that I had bookmarked. Hold up. Let me say just a few more things about Papaw. Papaw was a good man. You know, you get a chance to be close to someone for a long time. He had a good heart. He and his wife had certainly a different way of relating to each other than I and my wife have. And I would imagine every couple has a slightly different way of relating to each other. So it was interesting to be able to observe that close up. It was certainly a surprise that he was the first one out of the four. But as I've mentioned on the podcast for several weeks running now, it was not unexpected. We knew it was coming. As I mentioned on the podcast last week, for a while there, it looked like we were going to have two funerals, but my dad seems to be doing fine. We're settling back into a rhythm, and the oxygen does seem to be helping him. So all in all, we're doing okay. But I thought the whole everyone in Papaw's family commended themselves very well during the whole process. The family was warm and inviting and helpful. There was not, thankfully, lots of arguing and bickering, and there was, you know, there was just none of that. It was a very peaceful time, obviously a very sorrowful time. But there is very much the clinging to and holding to the hope and living through that hope. Some very, very sweet moments. Some very beautiful expressions of love and adoration. And the funeral was lovely. There was a full house for the funeral. Lynette put up on Facebook that her dad had died and wrote a very nice tribute on Facebook. And there were lots and lots of people who responded and responded very positively and glowingly about the impact that Doug Jernigan had had in their lives. And so it was very nice. It was very nice. It was lovely. Anyways, that's what I have to say about that. So moving on. Anyways, I came across this article, and the title of the article was "Want to Raise Successful Daughters? ? Science Says Nag the Heck Out of Them." And of course, well, that caught my attention. So I thought, let's see what this guy has to say. This was by Bill Murphy Jr. He said, "Someday my daughter is going to kill me for this one, but it's a story that will vindicate parents everywhere. Researchers in the United Kingdom say parents' super high expectations for their teenage daughters," and note this study is for daughters. I'm not sure this will work as well for boys, but this is for girls. Super high expectations of their teenage daughter, especially if they reminded them constantly of those expectations, are among the most important factors in predicting whether young girls will grow up to become successful women. As a university press release put it, "Behind every successful woman is a nagging mom? ? Teenage girls more likely to succeed if they have pushy mothers." That's pretty interesting. Essex University did this study. They said that the girls whose main parent, that's usually the mother, consistently displayed high parental expectations were far less likely to fall into the traps that made girls less likely to succeed in life. Specifically, these girls were less likely to become pregnant as teenager, more likely to attend college, less likely to get stuck in dead-end low-wage jobs, less likely to have prolonged periods of unemployment. Okay, now you always want to know how deep the study was, you know, how robust. The researchers, led by PhD candidate Erica G. Ranscon Ramirez, studied the experiences of more than 15,000 British girls aged 13 and 14 over a 10-year period. Okay, that's pretty good. Of course, avoiding the prime pitfalls doesn't necessarily mean the girls are destined to become the next Sheryl Sandberg, blah, 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 but it does mean they'll be more likely to preserve their opportunities to succeed later. And that, dear parents, is the point at which your work is done. When your child's success becomes much more a factor of their desire and work ethic than yours. And that is true. You know, nothing was more gratifying than seeing my daughter tighten in. There was a time, you know, when I was watching her motivations and I could see her struggling to pick between doing the thing that needed to be done and sort of doing that later. And I remember thinking to myself, come on, Lizzie, turn in. And then it's just like everything tightened up and there was a focus that came and it was like, there it is. We are good to go. So nagging more apparently gives specifically daughters a little recording that plays in their head and perhaps even helps them to fight the flesh within them. That's interesting. There's another subtitle here that says, rolling eyes, that means it's working. Quoting from the article, nice study, some readers might reply, have you actually tried being a parent tasked with nagging a 13 or 14-year-old daughter? Newsflash, whether we're talking about boys or girls, it could quickly deconstruct you into a cacophony of eye rolls, door slams, and sullenness. Okay, but parents can take solace in one idea the researchers entertained. The more it seemed hectoring. I don't think that's the right word. I think that means that should be heckling. Anyways, the more it seems hectoring them, I'm going to have to look that up after the podcast now because I am not familiar with that word. Hector. Isn't a Hector? I don't know. Anyways, sorry. The more it seems hectoring them is like pounding on a brick wall, the more it seems to be working. Quote, in many cases, we succeeded in doing what we believe is more convenient for us, even when this is against our parents' will, writes Ranscon Ramirez. But no matter how hard we tried to avoid our parents' recommendations, it's likely they end up influencing our choices. In other words, the writer of the article says, if your tween or teenage daughter rolls her eyes and says something like, ah, Mom, you're so annoying, what she really means deep down in her subconscious mind is, thank you for the helpful advice. I shall endeavor to act accordingly. What's interesting is they also found that stacking these expectations worked better. So if you said that you expected them to go to college and they weren't going to get pregnant as teenagers, they were more likely to make it to age 20 without having the child than if you had just been pushing the don't have a baby until you're old enough to be ready. As my colleagues at Scared Mommy, where I first heard about the study, put it, quote, sure, having a healthy sense of esteem and believing that you have options are great, but not getting pregnant just because you don't want to hear it is fine with us too. Whatever. Just make it not be so. It's interesting. The author of the article then goes on and says, I don't know about you, but even as a man in my 40s, I sometimes hear my parents' cautionary words or even my grandparents when I go to do something I probably shouldn't. My grandfather passed away in 1984. But if I ever overdo it on dessert, it's his voice I hear calling me out of it. assuming this study holds value for boys as well, and there's no reason to think it wouldn't. Well, there is. We'll get to that in a minute. That means I have my parents' habit of consistently expressing their high expectations to thank, at least in part, for my success. So thanks for the nagging, Mom and Dad. And to my darling daughter, believe me, this will be harder on me than it is for you. So, why do I think that maybe this works better for boys than for girls? I think it's going to depend on the relationship that you have. On average, in general, because we always speak of on average in general terms, I think young women, young girls are more apt to want to please than boys are. And so the nagging probably makes a bigger impact on them because they were afraid of what will happen if they don't follow their parents' advice. And most assuredly, most certainly, if there's not a strong relationship with a young boy, young man growing up, if that young boy and young man do not feel loved, do not feel embraced, do not feel seen and appreciated, I think we would find that the nagging really is not going to make that much of a difference. I have some real life examples of this in my experience, because in my mom's family, there were 8 kids. There was actually a 9th who died when he was 9. I've talked about that on the podcast at some point. But of those 8 kids, 5 of them ended up staying with Jesus. 3 of them did not. 5 of them were girls. 3 were boys. They all grew up in the same environment. But I wasn't there to see it, but from what I've been told, grandfather on my mom's side was very authoritarian, very demanding. We might translate that as very nagging. But apparently there was not the kind of connection that there could be between my grandfather and my uncles. And because of that, as soon as they got out of that house, I mean, his philosophy was, you're under my roof, you follow my rules, you do what I tell you to do, blah, 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 no quarter given, yada, yada. And apparently once they got out from under his roof, they were done. So that's why I say I think this probably works better for girls than it works for boys. However, if there is a relationship, if there is love, if there is acceptance, if there is a recognition that the young man understands that he is seen and that he is appreciated, I think you're going to stand a much, much, much better chance of nagging and or gentle instruction making a difference. Because I personally believe that while nagging is effective, there are things that are much more effective than nagging. I know for sure I've told this story on the podcast before, but it bears repeating. Years ago, I was having breakfast with a friend, and he was telling me, I just don't know what we're going to do with my son. It's just argumentative all the time. You know, anything we say, he's just arguing with us. That he's got to argue his way, that he's just gotta. And he said, I just don't know what to do with him. He's 12. Da-da-da-da, he's 12. I mean, honestly, you're laying the foundations. You're laying the foundations for those preteen years and those adolescent years all through a young man's life, all through a young woman's life, up to that point. So you certainly can't just completely change things in one moment, but there are things that you can do that will help. And he said, we just don't know what to do with him. I said, well, why don't you try something like this? Next time you say, we need to do thus and so, and he responds, well, I can't do this. Well, why can't we do that? Well, you said we do this. Well, you know, you didn't say this, you said that. Well, you just, you know, I said, why don't you sit down with him? And I said, sit next to him and put your arm around him. because touch is important. Put your arm around him. Not in a threatening way. Put your arm around him and say something like this. We'll call him Tom. Put your arm around him and say, you know, Tom, first of all, I love you. And I am amazed at the gifts that God has given you. I'm amazed at how quickly your mind works and how fast you can come up with scenarios. I don't know what you're going to find to do that will really engage these abilities that you have. I don't know if you're going to be a politician or a lawyer. I don't know. But I do know this. There's going to come a time when you are going to move out of this household. You are going to become a part of the work community, and you're going to need to get a job and be able to produce in the workforce. And from our experience in the workforce, I can tell you there will be certain expectations. There will be an expectation from whomever your boss is that when your boss asks you to do something, you're going to do it. And if every time your boss asks you to do something, you give him this slew of options and slew of backtalk about who you would rather do it this way or that way or the other way and not the way he wants, you will lose your job. Because most bosses will not be interested in hearing that. So as you move through your teenage years here, part of our job as parents is to help prepare you for the job market. Now, you might say, well, I'm never going to have a job like that. Well, I'm never going to do that. Well, I'm never this. Well, I'm never that. And you may figure out a way to pull that off. But the chances are you are going to have to start working somewhere. The chances are you are going to work for a boss you don't like, but you're going to do it because you need the money. And so our job right now is to prepare you for those eventualities. And then once you get out in the work job, you know, work market for a while, and you get your feet under you and you work your way up the chain, then you can become the boss, or you can start your own business, or you can, but there's going to be a period of time in here where you're going to need this skill. And that's why over the next several years, 6 years here or so, there are going to be times when we're just going to say, yep, we got to get this done. Let's do this right now. And you're not going to like that. But I'm just going to look at you and I'm going to smile and say, you know what? I love you. And this is all part of that training we talked about. I said, try that, something like that on him. But the key elements are you tell him you love him. And you really need to show him that you love him every day. You explain what you're trying to accomplish. And then you move forward. And absolutely, you expect him to get done what needs to be done. The wind is coming up! And I'm just a huge, huge believer in keeping those lines of communication open with children. In making sure that children know that they are loved. And that they are present with you, and that they have your attention. I got so tickled for the funeral and stuff. Lynette's nephew's son, so he would be our great nephew. He would be my great nephew-in-law. Little guy, full of personality, but doesn't warm up to a ton of people. For some reason, he has taken a liking to me. To his mother's amazement, she told me the other night when we were doing the visitation, she looked at me and she said, he really loves you. I said, I know, it's fun. And I confided in her. I said, you know, whenever I hear him, whenever he calls my name, Uncle Phil, I immediately stop what I'm doing and rotate around and look at him and give him a smile. I want him to know he is seen. He is appreciated. I enjoy him as a person. And it's amazing how well kids will respond to that. If you don't ignore them, if you are aware of their presence, and you let them know that you are aware of their presence. And that then becomes a foundation that will build out, give you an opportunity to get into the deepest parts of children's lives if you do that, if you stay engaged. And then, of course, the other big, big thing, and then I have to wrap this up because I've been talking out here for 25 minutes, it looks like. And then, of course, the other big thing for me is that I think it's vitally important as followers of Jesus Christ that our children see the involvement of Jesus Christ in our lives every day, that they see us relying on him every day. I always think it's so sad when I encounter friends and I talk to them about my upbringing and the life I had growing up with my parents and their constant engagement with Jesus and their constant reliance on him for help. I was thinking this week, you know, I'll have some eulogies coming up in the next 5 years. And one of those is going to be for my mom. And I can absolutely say with confidence how I'm going to start it off. Or at least somewhere in there, I'm going to talk about the seven-word question. Seven-word question. Have you asked Jesus to help you? Critical seven-word question that mom repeated to me over and over and over. Not naggingly, but repeated to me over and over and over. Have you asked Jesus to help you? Because that seven-word question resolves down into a four-word statement that is absolutely crucial for a successful life, as long as we will acknowledge it and believe it. And that four-word statement is, Jesus will help you. Jesus will help you. Jesus will help me. I was going to say, this is Phil Ferrand and I have made it home, but I am already home. So I will just say, this is Phil Ferrand. Have a great week.